And why is it something made in Africa supposed to be cheap? Because you associate Africa with charity. Well, I can tell you something, that model is redundant. Because Africa is where we should be looking for massive amounts of skilled workforce. Nigeria will have the youngest population in the world in a couple of years, and you've got no government support and a failing aid system. So people want to work and they want to rise out of poverty. And I think that one of the ways to do that is business. It's not the silver bullet, for sure. But I think the Africa charity concept is something that is just born out of ignorance now, to be honest.
Ask Anna Robertson, who made her clothes, she can tell you. She might talk about Hope, that's a tailor from Togo who brought his family to Ghana to find work. Apart from having the best name in the business, Hope is one of the best dressed men in Ghana's capital city, with an impeccable eye for tailoring. Or Anna might tell you about beautiful Evelyn, who is from the eastern region of Ghana, and has been a seamstress for 8 years. When Evelyn is not working, she attends adult literacy classes. Or maybe she'll mention Philomena, who is a single mother from Ghana's capital, Accra. When Philomena first came to the workshop that Anna set up in Ghana, she was sewing on garment labels, a really simple job. But she's since acquired new skills and is responsible for making complex things like bags or hats. Philomena has a daughter, Angie, and the majority of the income that she makes goes towards school fees. In this episode, we're going to meet this incredible human who is bringing us these stories and more. Anna Robertson runs Yevu, a super cool designer fashion label and social enterprise that's based in Ghana. Anna's like this crackers powerhouse of a person who never takes no for an answer, who took it upon herself to create a fashion brand, even though she knew nothing about fashion, in order to bring opportunity to Ghanaian micro-producers and workers in the country's informal sector. Yevu is so joyful. I reckon it's one of the kind of happiest-inducing brands that I can think of. That's partly down to the prints, the African waxcloth prints that it's famous for, very colourful and very bright, but it's also down to its ethos. You're in for a treat to hear from Anna. Hey, mate.
Hi, Claire.
Thank you so much for joining us on this very special Fashion Revolution podcast series.
Thank you so much for having me.
Actually, I'm going to start by asking you about Fash Rev. Why do you think people are more excited about this movement that's really taken off in the last 4 years?
I think that people are wanting to buy less crap, basically.
Yeah.
I know that that's something that I've become much more aware of after running Yevu, just being more considerate about what you buy and where it's coming from. I mean, it just makes sense, doesn't it?
So it's tapping into this broader movement. People are just like fed up with being...
I think so. I think people are sick of buying things that are made to last for a year or less or a season. Like when it not just clothing, it comes to everything. This sort of planned obsolescence that just forces us to keep on buying things. It's nice to be able to hold on to things. Yeah, exactly.
Because actually we're being duped, aren't we, by the system that tells us we need stuff that's been designed to throw away. Anna, you run an extraordinary social enterprise based in Accra, Ghana's capital. Could you perhaps sum it up for us in a couple of sentences? What is your mission?
Yevu is a social business and we work with artisanal manufacturers from Ghana's informal sector to create economic and creative opportunities. But I guess on a broader level, we work in a way that puts the people and the place first. So we pay homage to Ghana, which is where we produce and which is the place where all of the incredible textiles come from. And we put the people that work for us at the centre of all the decisions that we make for the business.
I pick up on that phrase, informal sector. It's not immediately, I don't immediately understand what that means, and maybe other people don't. Can you explain to us exactly what that looks like on the ground in Ghana when it comes to the textiles industry?
The informal sector is not something that I was super familiar with before going over to Ghana either, but it's what anyone who's traveled in developing countries or low to middle income countries, they are, like, will be familiar with it. They're the people that are selling food on the side of the street. They're the people at the local marketplace. They're the people making your clothes at a grassroots level. And in Accra, that takes up 70 to 80% of the working population, which is huge.
Huge.
And, I mean, it looks like it sounds. It's informalized. It's chaotic. It's messy. It's
unregulated.
It's totally unregulated. It's basically people who are self-employed or employing other people, but they're not part of the formal system. So they're not receiving payrolls. They're not paying taxes, which normally means that they're working in incredibly vulnerable, economically vulnerable and unsafe workplaces, really. You know, but with that said, that's a thriving economy in itself. I mean, what it looks like is like people selling puppy dogs at the streetlights.
Wow.
And people selling, you know, from puppy dogs to ab crunching machines to bananas to toilet paper to water sachets. I mean, Ghana's economy is really, and West Africa's economy is really built around these people who are providing goods and services for daily consumption. People don't have access to basic needs and provisions, and it's the informal economy that are sort of setting that up.
So you're from Sydney.
Yes.
You ended up in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us that tale.
Didn't know what I was doing. Got a job through the AusAid program.
And were you studying at the time? I know that you've got more than one degree.
Yes. So I wasn't studying. I'd finished studying. I'd done a double major political economy, and I'd finished my honours. And then I'd sort of been working in the development sector in Australia for various groups who run projects abroad. And then I got the job through AusAid, and I hadn't really Ghana wasn't one of the jobs I'd applied for. As ignorant as it is, I didn't know where Ghana was.
I was going to ask you, like, yeah. Had you never been to West Africa before?
Never been to, no, I mean, I'd been to Morocco, which most people who have been over to that part, to Europe at least, will go over to Morocco, but I hadn't even considered West Africa.
So you literally didn't know where Ghana was on the map?
Couldn't point it out to you.
Wow. What was it like to fetch up there? Did you go first to Accra?
Yeah, so you arrive in Accra. It's just a really chaotic sort of sprawling urban mess. There's not a lot of urban planning around the city, but with that said, it was way more developed than what I thought it was going to be in the city. I've never gotten so lost in my entire life. I ended up in another city accidentally one time.
Travelling by bus or something?
Yeah, travelling by Chocho, which are the mini buses that like take you from point A to point B. Again, they don't have any numbers. They don't have any names. There's no direct and obvious route. You just have to stand on a corner and hope that the mini bus you get on is the right one. I think that I made Ghana my home.
I was about to say.
Yeah, really quickly. And realised that in order to sort of last at least that first sort of 12-month period working in a pretty difficult situation, even just culturally at the organisation that I was at initially, it was difficult. I was not accepted and it was, you know, challenging.
Just in brief, what was the work that you were doing as a volunteer?
I was working at a think tank, a big sort of non-government group in Ghana, who basically are the biggest body that observes the elections in countries that are sort of, I guess, newly democratized in a way, or might have had a history of civil war. There's generally external, non-partisan observation groups that work on the elections. And in a lot of places, you might get the EU or the African Union doing that. But in Ghana, because it's a fairly stable country, it's a local group that manages that.
The first thing I think in the context of this conversation is, how do you make the leap from that to fashion? And I know we've talked before this interview about how you were initially quite resistant to the idea of working in the fashion space.
I think it's still something that doesn't sit 100% comfortably with me. And I think that comes from coming, I guess, more from, well, from a background that's completely different to the fashion industry per se. But what I've learned is there are so many skills, and my experience in development have really informed the direction that the business has taken. But in terms of fashion, I think that, I mean, I don't know, it just, I guess fashion's always been associated with superficiality, which is just so untrue. I mean, it's the same as food. I mean, every human being wakes up and puts on clothes.
Mm.
It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and there are like something like 70 million people worldwide employed in garment manufacturing.
And most of those are women.
Absolutely. huge majority of those are women, and they are working in horrible environments, basically, and living well and truly below the poverty line. So why is that acceptable?
Well, it isn't.
Well, it's not, and that's what we're starting to sort of, you know, talk about, I suppose, which is great.
But coming back to that idea of, or that question of, what was that moment when you thought, okay, the fashion space or the textiles industry or the clothing industry there in Ghana was the obvious place for you to start your new business?
Yeah, I think that it was definitely the fact that Ghana was the home to this incredible textile industry.
Right.
First and foremost, it was the textiles that was the buy-in for me. And it was the ability to be able to see that that was going to work in a different context.
So was it the visual that you just see this fabric everywhere?
It was the visual, and then it
was... I say that because we're both wearing the same print from Yeovu. It's the same. We're like twins.
Yeah, we've got similar taste, obviously.
But there is this great kind of vibrancy to these prints. You can't look away, right?
What is produced in West Africa is very different to what's produced in East and Southern parts of Africa. And it was the vibrancy of those prints that really caught my attention.
The very distinctive Ghanaian wax print.
Yeah.
Why is it different? Can you talk to me a little bit about kind of how it happened, how it grew up?
It's called a Dutch wax print, basically, and it was introduced to West Africa by the Dutch via Indonesia.
Right.
So when done by hand, it's a batik process.
Right.
So what happened in Ghana when the Dutch sort of introduced this sort of cloth there, which is a resilient cotton cloth, perfect for the weather in many ways, Ghanaians really made it their own, and they formalized it and created textile industries around it, which a lot of which are, you know, were owned by overseas companies, especially Vlisco, which is a Dutch company. They still operate a couple of factories in Ghana now, but they're locally managed and locally run.
And did you tell me that until the 80s, there were about 300,000 people employed by this sector?
Yeah, that's right. About 70s, 80s, 300,000 people employed. And now you've got, I think, 10% of that, or maybe less. And that's a result of massive government shifts towards a import-orientated economy. They're now, you know, what was being produced locally for export regionally and locally is now being replaced by textiles that are being, and other things that are being produced mainly in Asian countries for half the price.
But when we're talking about these really beautiful, authentic, original, distinctive West African prints, we're talking about Chinese knockoffs that look the same, but were made in a factory in China, right?
Totally, yeah. And the reason why it's very hard to distinguish is, in many ways, is because the designs that are being produced externally are Ghanaian designs. So they are counterfeit fabrics.
Wow.
Because the designs and the colours are what makes them unique to Ghana and West Africa. So it's not necessarily, to the naked eye, it might not necessarily be a knowledge of where they're produced, but just the design and the colours that are used. And the designers that work for the textile companies in Ghana just do an incredible job. And they're producing for local consumption. So they're using phrases and stories and symbols on the prints that communicate to the local population.
The power of those prints, as we said, you can't look away. Mm-hmm. I can see that that would have led you into going, okay, I want to know more about the textiles industry. But what were the steps that then took you from that kind of peripheral interest to going, all right, I'm going to actually set up this social enterprise that's based on that world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was a understanding of the challenges that people face in Ghana, like the majority of people who are categorized as sort of even middle class. They call it rising Africa, which is still people who are living on like $2 a day. I mean, that's just, you can't live off that over there. You just can't. So it was even just this understanding that people were, you know, possibly becoming more aware of the global world and becoming better educated, but just lacked access to employment. Huge underemployment issues, especially amongst youth. And then also the knowledge that most of these micro enterprises in the informal sector are female owned. And women just have much less access to savings, technology. They can't expand their businesses. They can't increase their earnings. And that's going to have a detrimental effect on their families, or an inability to sort of like educate their children more. So there was like all these sort of factors that came into it. And then knowing that there was a very, really big skilled artisanal manufacturing sector within that informal sector was, I guess, the catalyst. And it was just my sort of personally knowing a couple of women who worked in that area who had been making stuff for myself for work and other functions.
Oh, so you'd had things made for yourself?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, every Friday in Ghana is like National Dress Day.
Is it?
Awesome. It's like our jeans Friday in Australia, but you get to work and everyone's
in the print.
Head to toe print. So I kind of felt like a bit boring in my like black and white pantsuit.
I love it.
So I was getting stuff made and, you know, I guess got to know a couple of women quite personally.
I got to ask you, how did you feel, as in what did those clothes make you feel like when you put them on, having been in
your... I felt happy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt really happy. And
look at us, we're happy.
I'm so happy.
But it is, isn't it?
It is. Well, it's also a good conversation point. I mean, a lot of my colleagues were more willing to accept me if I was dressing in local textile. For them, it was like... here's a foreigner that's completely accepting our culture and our practice. There's nothing negative about it. So I think when the argument of cultural appropriation has come up, I feel like saying, why don't you ask the people that you're talking about?
That is such an interesting point.
Yeah. There was never any issue with that. It was celebrated. And it's a point of pride for Ghanaians, at least the ones that I know and work with.
Okay, let me take you back to that kind of first setting up period. So you had a few things made, you knew people who were able to make things, you'd witnessed firsthand the power of the celebratory nature of wearing something cool and vibrant and local. I reckon most people would have stopped there, but you didn't stop there.
Probably should have stopped there.
What were the steps that then led to you opening Yevu, which I keep saying Yevu and it's Yevu.
No, you're saying
Say
it
again.
Fine. It's just your accent.
I sound like
Yevu. You don't have the Australian accent, so, you know, it just sounds different.
How do you say it in Ghana?
Yevu.
And yet, for some reason, I want to say it's like, yay, because I feel like it's cheerful.
I was going to start a black and white only label called Novu. So.
All right. So what were the first steps that you had to take to set up that workshop?
Initially, it was a sort of ad hoc approach to production, in the sense like I don't have any fashion experience. I wasn't pretending to. I wanted to do something that was, you know, a 200 piece collection of unisex sort of pieces, like jackets and shorts and that. I knew two women who ran sort of small workshops that employed about three or four women each, and they had the space to do it. And I basically went and bought the prints that I thought would work. I just kept visualising them on my friends in Sydney, basically.
And you bought these prints from the local marketplace?
Yeah. And at that stage probably got exorbitantly ripped off. I know the prices now. And basically just handed the work over and said, you know, let's do this and can you have it ready in a month? And
how did you design it? How did you know what shapes you were going for?
I was using samples that I had with me. We'd do a little bit of sampling with them.
Figuring it out.
And it was just figuring it out as we went. I mean, there's no pattern making sort of approach to production. It's a bespoke, you know, tailor-made sort of thing. So in terms of copying pieces, that's incredibly easy. When it comes to, I guess, mass producing and creating sizing and consistency, which is key to obviously operating a clothing label, there was nothing set up like that. So initially we just went with the skill set that was available to us at the time, and we worked with mainly home-based workers. That was fine for that. And then, you know, I came back and we had a little shop in Cleveland Street, Surry Hills, and we sold that. There was so little planning. All I knew was that I wanted to set up a space that kind of recreated, I suppose, the feeling that I had in Ghana, and people really responded to that.
When did it become clear that the outsourcing that you were doing wasn't going to be sustainable in terms of how you wanted to shape the workshop and the brand?
It became clear because I went back to Ghana maybe 2 months after that initial store and realised that our work was being outsourced and outsourced again. And
so down the line, that supply chain that you thought was very short was actually long, but you didn't even know.
And I realised that because what we were getting back was crap quality and wasn't what we had discussed with the makers. And then, you know, what you do is you go to the place. You go and figure out what's going on. You track people down. And I've done that several times in the early days, just like literally walking around a community asking where Tete is.
How did it make you feel to see that what you'd planned didn't turn out that way and maybe you couldn't be sure that your supply chain was being run as beautifully as you wanted it to be run?
I understood it. Like, I did, because...
Were you mad?
No, I was just, like, annoyed at myself for being so stupid, I think. I wasn't mad at the situation because I was like, well, you know, I would do what I had to do if I was in this situation as well. But what I realised pretty quickly was that we really needed to centralise production and I needed to figure out how serious I was about the business and, like, if there was, like, financially we had to make sure it was viable. I mean, we're not a charity. We've never received any donations or grants or anything like that. We need to be able to sell our product and create commercial revenue in order to achieve what our social impact is, basically.
But you would also have to be really sure that what you were making was going to sell, that there was going to be repeat business, that totally. You were going to be able to continue what you started, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, every time we release a new range, I'm like, no one's going to buy it. Like, you know, I think that's like the same for anyone who does anything creative that's received by people, like whether it's artists or whatever. I mean, there's always going to be that fear. But for us, we've got people that are relying on that income. So the other thing that was translated pretty early on, once we had established a team who still work with us over there, 20 people strong and incredibly close-knit and cooperative sort of working space, we were really clear about communicating that in order for them to sort of stay in jobs, which is what we very much wanted to do, and to be able to pay them the wages we were paying them, we had to have a mutual investment in the business, which was like they need to keep up their end of the bargain. There's had to be some hard conversations with people that I think saw it as a bit of a handout that we were working with originally, and that comes from me being a foreigner, 100%. We had to sift sort of those people out and work with people that really wanted to be there and understood mm-hmm. the values of the business and understood that people are directly consuming things that they've, you know, they have ownership over, because we have one person making each style. So they really have ownership over that.
If you hop onto the website, which is yevuclothing.com, and I would really encourage you to do that, guys, just to see the designs and read some of the press, but also to read the stories of the makers. So you're hyper transparent. You tell the stories of the individuals who are making these clothes, and it's beautiful. That's what makes it so special, right? Yeah. But can you talk a little bit about what your workshop looks like and who the people are that are making these beautiful clothes?
Well, to be honest, we've just moved workshop. We're in the process of moving and I'm flying over to Ghana in 2 weeks right. to manage that. And that happened quite suddenly. The workshop we've been working out of in central Accra was, you know, a huge sort of property partially ruined by flooding, but a beautiful old workshop with huge big windows and a big sort of cooperative working space. We had 16 machines in there. We had men and women who've been working with us for years and years, managed by our production manager, Felicia, who's been the longest seamstress that's worked for us, who's received quite a bit of training with us and has then gone on to train a lot of the other workers.
And many of the workers that are coming to Accra looking for work, I think it's like a quarter of the population live there, right?
Totally,
but
yeah.
Many of them come in from villages from somewhere else. So
sure. You've
had to provide accommodation,
oh, yeah.
Is that right?
So, yeah. So we provide accommodation for anyone who needs it because, yeah, as you said, a lot of the workers that we work with, actually none of them are from Accra. They've all moved into the city to find work. Most of the people that we work with are from rural villages in the Volta region, or Togo, and we provide accommodation for men and women there and cooking resources. We have 2 full-time nannies working at the workshop because many of the women are mums with young children, and we provide food. We do a big cook-up every Friday at the workshop.
Do you?
And everyone wears their Yevu polo shirts. That sounds really weird, but branded polo shirts are really big. In Ghana, if you work for a company or an organization, polo shirts are just it's a sense of place. And
I was going to say, like a matter, like on the team.
Absolutely, it's like yeah. A team shirt that happens every Friday, and you know we keep the workshop fully resourced, so their basic needs are provided for. So whatever they earn on top of that is money that can go towards school fees, predominantly improved nutrition for their family, and a lot of them save to buy machinery or to improve their households. And, you know, the fact that they can put money away is really great.
What has been some of the harder things that you've had to work through. You know, what are the biggest challenges and how have you solved them?
I feel like I kind of wear two hats because I spend so much of my time mitigating the everyday challenges that come up in Ghana. Flooding has been a major issue. We've lost quite a bit of machinery and, you know, we want our workers to be in a safe environment, so that's why we've just moved. Lack of electricity, especially in certain periods when there's no election coming up, there's always like a lot of electricity right before an election. So we try and produce as much as we can in that period. Other than that, you're operating generators with diesel.
So then they get in and they go, we don't need to dry now.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your other hat?
The other hat is my business management skills and my customer facing and my product development and all these things that I don't have much experience in, to be honest. Having confidence in what I'm selling and trying to figure out where to sit within the Australian sort of independent label landscape has been really hard because, as we said before, like it's not really something that comes naturally or sits totally comfortably with me. I have no problem receiving criticism and questions, I think are really important, and I really encourage people to like ask those questions. But, you know, there can be some naysayers. About aesthetics, about cultural appropriation, and about just like, I think there's more scrutiny sometimes applied to companies that promote their transparency more, which is really fascinating. You know, I have people, you know, come into the store and say, why is this price? And I say, well, do you go into Uniqlo and ask why a shirt's $50? If you don't do that, then don't come in. I give the answers. I've got a spreadsheet right here that can tell you that. But I'm, you know, why is that an attitude that you have? And why is it something made in Africa supposed to be cheap? Because you associate Africa with charity. Well, I can tell you something, that model is redundant because Africa is where we should be looking for massive amounts of like skilled workforce. Nigeria will have the youngest population in the world in a couple of years, and you've got no government support and a failing aid system. So people want to work and they want to rise out of poverty. And I think that one of the ways to do that is business. It's not the silver bullet for sure, but I think the Africa sort of charity concept is something that is just born out of ignorance now, to be honest.
How important do you think the story behind what you do is to selling the clothes?
I think that the initial buy-in for our customers is the product, to be honest. I think that what comes secondary, but close secondary, is that the fact that people are like pleasantly surprised about the story and to know that what they're buying is not only a print that's been, you know, exported and made somewhere else or bought in China or whatever. It's like being sourced directly from the marketplace. There's dirt there, there's sweat, there's a real connection to place.
And also, I think you told me a story about talking to customers and someone had said to you that they had been approached by someone and asked, what are you wearing? It's amazing.
A lot of the time.
And then become real friends, formed a friendship out of the clothes.
Yeah, 100%.
I love that.
I mean, it's such a nice sort of positive, like unexpected positive outcome for the business that you've got people who are talking about where their clothes are from and making friendships out of it and sending me emails directly with a selfie of them just being like, love my new jumpsuit. People coming in the store because someone else has told them about it and then someone else in the store overhearing that conversation and saying the same thing. It's the word of mouth for the business has been really good for us.
I'd love to finish just by talking about how the guys in your workshop feel about the product and how they relate to some of these beautiful stories. Like, what do they think and how do they view the work and the clothes?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think like having that full circle is so nice. And the fact that I get to be able to be a part of that, I feel really good about because, I mean, all the work that gets done in Sydney in terms of the stores and the imagery and the press and all of that sort of stuff, like that gets sent back to Ghana.
Yeah.
Like everyone, which helps now that they've got a couple of computers there and they know how to use them. I mean, from what I see and from what I've experienced, there's a sense of pride there. And we, you know, because I come from a monitoring and evaluation background, we are constantly surveying and interviewing our makers to A, make sure that everything's going okay, and to B, check in about where they're at in terms of like what they're spending their money on, you know, if they need to look for other work or, you know, all of these sorts of things. And from what I've seen, there's like a huge loyalty to the business now because I think they've been able to see that what they're creating is being really enjoyed by people that they don't know.
It's so fabulous. Actually, I can't let you go without just asking you to just explain about what a living wage is in Ghana and also what you pay your workers.
Totally. I mean, what we've paid our team on the ground are prices that have been set by them initially, and we factor in sort of inflation and cost of living and that, and usually every production cycle up, prices will increase. The difficult thing is that informal sector workers don't know what their annual wage is. So what we basically do is we have our production periods, everyone works full time, we look at how much on average everyone's making, and then we look at that over the course of the year and make sure that is set above Ghana's living wage for people in their sector. So the living wage is usually, I think it's about four times above the minimum statutory minimum wage that's set for Ghana, which is set by the government, which is 8 CDs 60 a day. That's about $2.80. Exchange rates just changed. Yeah, $2.80 Australian a day.
And you can't live on that in Ghana?
Hell no. You know, even rent is incredibly expensive over there for everyone. Transportation is expensive because of the fuel shortages. I mean, yeah, it's a highly inflationary economy. So living wage is basically factoring in what people actually are doing in their day-to-day. Factoring in transport, factoring in a basic, they call it like a basic basket of food, which is like set worldwide, you know, your basic needs per day of what you might need to eat. They look at what things cost in country and then set a living wage. So at the moment we're paying just above the living wage.
Fantastic.
Sorry, I hope that wasn't dry. Because I think they're things that terms that I've kind of take for granted a little bit because...
But the shopper doesn't know.
Yeah, but the shopper doesn't know.
They know you're doing it right, but they want to know how right.
My friends sort of say to me, like, you're using development speak. Like, use, like, words that people can apply meaning to. And I'm like, good one.
Did you record that? Yeah. We need that. Okay. Come on.
Like, kind of like, you know, yeah.
And anyway. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
As usual. No, it really has. It's fascinating to hear your story, which I think is a unique one and like such a visually powerful one. Like, it's not hard to buy into this as an idea.
It's not. And I think that's another surprising thing. It's just like, it's not, okay, look, unless you want to make millions of dollars, like, it's not incredible. It's not that hard. I mean, I say that and then I'm like, God, I've wanted to quit so many times. I don't think it's that hard to run a business well and not screw people over at the same time. They read something they thought was interesting.
Who Made My Clothes is a co-production between Jackrabbit FM and Fashion Revolution Australia and New Zealand. It's hosted by me, Claire Press from Wardrobe Crisis, and produced by Brooke McCallery. Editing is by Ryan Pemberton and Brooke McCallery. And you can find out more about the show and about all the brands that we feature by hopping onto the Fashion Revolution website.
Thank you to The Hipstones for the music. This track is Read Your Mind from the album Wise Man, available on iTunes or Spotify. To hear more, go to thehipstones.com. To find out more information and to take part in Fashion Revolution Week, head to the website. It's fashionrevolution.org and you need to search for Australia or New Zealand. On social media, search for the hashtags WhoMadeMyClothes and Fashion Revolution, and you'll find heaps of inspiration as to how you can get involved.
Jackrabbit FM.
For your ears.
Who is that? Hi, Puck Pass.